Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Tim Phillips as we tackle our latest review in this latest COVID-19 lockdown version of the show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new jazz documentary biography, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, which is presently streaming on Netflix. It seems timely, I guess, to do something documentary related, considering that April is typically the month, at least late in April is typically the month where we have Hot Docs in Toronto, North America's largest documentary film festival. I have been to Hot Docs several times. It is a very funky time, much more relaxed and sort of low-key than TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, which, attracts all kind of film goers. The people who are so into documentaries, they go to a documentary film festival, are a very different type of film viewer, and are much more, let's say, laid back and much more inquisitive and introspective than somebody who's just trying to maybe catch a Hollywood star at the Toronto International Film Festival, or to see what might win an Oscar or something like that. So in honor of all that, and in honor of Hot Docs, and in honor of this week's selection of Birth of the Cool, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, the new documentary, I'm going to spend the first portion of the show here doing a top 10 list of horror-related documentaries. It seems apropos, considering it's a scary situation right now with the lockdown. So maybe we can engage in horror in, sort of a healthy way. And, we have these documentaries, which are sort of true life. Some of them are about movies, but, they're grounded, of course, because that's what a documentary is. It's real life, captured on film, telling a story in a very real way. So, after that clumsy introduction, I'm just going to get right into my list, starting with number 10, which is a new series called Cursed Films, which is a Shudder original. It's on Shudder, the horror movie streaming service. It's a 5-part series. The last 2 parts come out this week. 3 parts have already been released, and they're about, obviously, cursed films. They've picked, the most obvious ones, so things like The Exorcist, The Omen, and Poltergeist. Poltergeist is probably the most famous cursed film of all time. But more than just sort of, explaining why they're cursed, what happened, the things that went on behind the scenes, there's also a lot of in-depth stuff about how we think about curses, how our minds form these patterns. They have the author of seven, I can't remember the exact title of the book, but it's like 7 Ways, 7 Tips for Magical Thinking, that kind of thing. Also people who, talk about, again, how our brains recognize patterns. There's actually a clip in the second episode where it recreates that famous gorilla experiment where you watch the basketball players pass the ball around and try to keep count of how many times they're passing the ball. And in doing so, most people don't see it when a person in a gorilla suit walks out into the middle of the court. So it gets you thinking about the curses, the cursed films in unique and different ways, and makes you question about whether or not they are really cursed to begin with, and whether or not maybe you understand what that means. My number 9 is a twofer. It is Crystal Lake Memories and Never Sleep Again, The Elm Street Legacy. These are films that they come from the same filmmaker, Daniel Ferrans, that laboriously recreate or sort of laboriously revisit these two big franchises, Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. The Nightmare on Elm Street one is The shortest one, at 240 minutes, the Friday the 13th one is 400 minutes long. It looks at every film in the franchise and looks at their grander cultural relevance and the grander reverence that each film has in its own series. I mean, a great portion of the Nightmare one is focused on Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which has come to be read in recent years for a number of its queer themes that it has, which the screenwriter says were explicit, and apparently no one else in the film realized. So there's a lot of really great engagement in that one. Still, if you're a fan of these franchises, these are must-watch movies. They are exhaustive, not exhausting, exhaustive in how much ground they cover, and they are both available on Shudder now. Next, sort of in the same vein, Room 237, which is Rodney Asher's film about the hidden meanings in The Shining. It is not a conventional documentary. Like, there's really no talking head segments. It covers about 9 different theories. All the different theories kind of float in and out. Different turns being taken. You know, you sort of go from Kubrick faked the moon landing into The Shining is a secret message about the elimination of American indigenous people. It's all terribly fascinating. I'm not sure any of it is legit. But having said that, it is fascinating to see how other people see this very influential and important movie. So that's Room 237. You can rent it on most of the streaming platforms, so Google, Apple, and YouTube. My number 7 is Haunters, The Art of the Scare, which is about people who are really into creating these like elaborate haunted houses and ask the question, like, maybe they're too into it. Maybe they're too obsessed with Halloween and horror and scaring people. There are a lot of really interesting characters in it, a lot of people who are very creative and very passionate, and those always make for great stories, and you get to see how they bring a lot of these really interesting haunted houses to life, how much time, effort, energy, and dedication goes into that. So that is Haunters, and you can find that on Amazon Prime. These next two films, which I'm kind of tying for number 6, you can also find on Amazon Prime. They are Cropsey and Killer Legends, and they are sort of symbiotic. They come from the same filmmaker, Joshua Zeman. Cropsey is about an urban legend in Staten Island, which is one of the 5 boroughs of New York City. How that the urban legend fed into this real-life true crime case of a young girl who was kidnapped and murdered in 1987, and how the urban legend fed into the craziness that came up around that case, and concerns about crazy people living in the woods and hook-handed killers and all that. And then Killer Legends, of course, kind of bounces off of that, because Cropsey is, of course, about urban legends. Killer Legends is about urban legends in other places. They go to the town in Texas that the town that Dreaded Sundown was based on. They talk about babysitter killers. They talk about tainted candy and trick-or-treaters, and the kind of origins for all these urban legends. And it's really kind of fascinating to see how the legends are born, how they kind of close to the real life stories, and how things kind of get blown up out of proportion. And speaking of out of proportion, Welcome to Leaf is a very real, very scary story about a man named Craig Cobb, who tried to establish a white nationalist settlement in a small town in North Dakota called Leaf. And how that blew up in his face when he was arrested for basically harassing his neighbors. Him and a friend walked through town, which is fairly easy because it's a small town of like maybe 100 people. They walked through town with machine guns. They were arrested, and Craig Cobb sort of follows him through to when he's released from prison, and he's kind of reformed, but not really. But it was a really terribly scary situation in this town in North Dakota, and the film is haunting because it's you're watching like these really terrible people doing really with really terrible ideas, and you're watching it sort of unfold, and how it affects the townspeople and how they're trying to respond, while at the same time not trying to aggravate these people who are clearly dangerous. And you can find Welcome to Leaf. You used to be able to find it on Hoopla. Sadly, now you have to get it on Google, Apple, or YouTube. This next one, number four, I'm terribly sorry it can't be found anywhere at the moment. It used to be on Shudder, but now it's not. It is Best Worst Movie, which sort of started this. I think it's a trend of documentaries that are revisiting old movies and talking about their themes and maybe how they've been recontextualized in the modern sense. Troll 2, of course, is very much a part of that. It was released in 1989, 1990. It was this really silly monster movie that more people laughed at than were really scared at. Of course, now the story is that was the intention all along, that it was supposed to be a goofy movie that people enjoyed at midnight screenings more than a serious horror movie. At least that's what the director is saying, and it gets into that in Best Worst Movie. It is interesting that this film was from Michael Stevenson, who was one of the young actors in Troll 2, and of course he's been at the center of how Troll 2 has become a cult classic, and Best Worst Movie kind of captures his experiences as part of that whirlwind. Unfortunately, like I said, you can't find it anywhere on the internet right now. You can, however, find Troll 2 itself on Apple. So if you want to at least dip a toe in, that's cool too. This is another tough one to find, Faces of Death. It is sort of a documentary, but not really, because portions of it were faked. There are allegedly some portions of it that are real too. Faces of Death came out in 78, and it purported to capture scenes of people dying, including one sequence where somebody is electrocuted in an electric chair. That has been since revealed to be faked. But it's like kind of YouTube before there was a YouTube, or even before there was like an E-Bombs World or like a Daily Motion or any of these sites where you could capture these sort of funky and illicit and terrible videos that people are sharing online so easily now. You used to only be able to get it in like bootlegs or through things like this, The Faces of Death, which spawned a whole series of sequels. I think they made 6 or 7 of them. Again, it's kind of hard to find. I think there are bootlegs on YouTube that you can watch, but like in order to see it proper, that's unfortunately difficult. I would recommend maybe as counter programming something on Shudder called Road Movie, which is basically dash cam footage from Russia and Eastern Europe of various things that people capture on their dash cam. It is very hypnotic viewing. Not quite in the same vein as Faces of Death, but a fairly decent substitute. That brings us to number two, which is American Movie. Again, I hate to say this, you can't find it anywhere to rent, but if you can find it, like maybe on DVD, on Amazon or eBay somewhere, it is very worth your time. It is about a man named Mark Borchgard, who is an independent filmmaker trying to make this grand sweeping drama called Northwestern. He lacks the resources to be able to do it, so instead he starts making a cheap horror movie that he thinks he can turn around quickly, make for the cheap, sell for big money, sell 3,000 copies on VHS. Yes, that's how long ago this was. And then get the resources he needs to make his movie Northwestern. The movie is called Coven, although he pronounces it as Coven with a long O, which just kind of adds to the silliness of Mark's character. He has obviously some very serious issues, and it's about as much his personal struggles as his struggles to make a film, which are, as anyone who's ever tried to make a film of their own knows, are substantial. It's easier said than done when it comes to making a movie, and even a low-budget one like Coven, and you learn that fairly quickly. So the number one horror-related doc I have to give you is The Nightmare, which you can find very easily on Apple. It is Rodney Asher again, the director of Room 237. I believe this was his follow-up to Room 237. And it has to deal with sleep paralysis and people who have nightmares that come from their sleep paralysis, like the scientific routes of sleep paralysis, why it happens, why people experience these nightmare visions while they suffer from sleep paralysis. And then it also recreates people's nightmares as, I guess, as kind of a way of dealing with them therapeutically, but also as a way of portraying to the audience just kind of how vivid and how scary these experiences are. And it's very effective. When you're sitting alone in your home, just watching the TV at night to sort of see these nightmares come to life, it is quite shocking. And I would even say unsettling in places. So there are 10 recommendations for you. I mean, although technically a few of them you won't be able to find, and I am sorry about that, but I like, keep your eyes open for them. If they should happen to pop up on, like, a, you know, even smaller sites like Tubi or something like that, well worth seeking out, especially American movie. I am going to rest my voice, and then we are going to get Tim on the line to review this week's new documentary that is not horror-related, although debatable. We are going to review Miles Davis' Birth of the Cool after this. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Like a curse with me. It's the first thing in my life. Go to bed thinking about it and wake up thinking about it. That's all I live for.
Miles started very early.
He looked at things differently. He saw things differently. Without a doubt, the most unique person I've ever known.
He wanted to be an artist just like Stravinsky.
A lot of the old guys thought that if you went to school, it would make you play like you were white. If you learned something from theory, you would lose the feeling in your playing. I wanted to see what was going on in all of music.
Juilliard, in the daytime and at night, he'd be on 52nd Street.
He put the bell of his horn right into the microphone and changed the whole world of jazz right there.
He comes up with a style that is truly reflective of who he is. He was angry, antisocial.
But then he starts playing and people are like, oh, he just disarms you.
He surrounded himself with young, emerging, unknown voices.
We were kids.
We were looking at every night going to a laboratory. Miles was a head chemist.
He wanted us to live on the stage, creating in front of the people. Don't lean on what you know. What he was looking for is the stuff that you don't know.
And that was a clip from Miles Davis' Birth of the Cool. It is the new film from Stanley Nelson, and it features narration by Carl Lumley as Miles Davis. Okay, and joining me for this week's review is Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. Doing well. Living the good life indoors. How about yourself, Adam?
Well, I'm also indoors. I'm not sure it's the good life, but it's definitely okay, and not feeling cabin fever yet, so that's pretty good.
Oh, that's good.
So, we're reviewing Miles Davis' Birth of the Cool, which premiered at Sundance in 2019 and is part of the American Masters series, which is a long-running series of profiles on PBS. in the United States. Well, we get PBS here in Canada too, I suppose, but a lot of these are sort of taken on their own as, and I guess maybe in the case of Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, it was originally produced as its own separate thing and then became part of the American Masters series. But for people who don't know, it's been running for like 30 plus years, American Masters, and it profiles like directors, famous writers, presidents, anyone who has even sort of a, I guess, legitimate claim to be called an American master. So, Tim, you wanted to review this, so I thought I would give you a chance right off the bat to say, to explain to the folks why this appealed to you and why you kind of wanted to discuss it in an in-depth way.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Adam. Well, looking on Netflix, you know, there's so many series on there, and I enjoy reviewing movies and tend to like fiction films. I like documentaries as well, but I don't watch a ton of documentaries. But this one popped up on Netflix and it caught my eye. Just coincidentally, recently I watched Elevator to the Gallows on Turner Classic Movies, which is a film noir from the 50s, a French film noir by Louis Malle. And the score was done by Miles Davis. And in the introduction of that film, they talked about the unusual way Miles Davis performed the score, where he performed it straight to the screen while they screened the movie for him. And he just played his trumpet while watching the movie, which I thought was really cool. And so he kind of was on my mind, Miles Davis, and I had been playing while in isolation, playing some of his music recently. So when I saw this pop up on Netflix, I was like, wow, that'd be a really, really interesting film to review. I anecdotally knew a little bit about his life, but didn't really know a whole lot other than his music. So I thought it'd be cool to review Birth of the Cool and learn more about what made him tick, you know, beyond just the artistic side, and how his personal relationships and growing up as a black man in the United States, like formed who he became as an artist. So I thought it'd be interesting to watch, and I'm glad you agreed to that, and I'm glad we had a chance to watch it.
I also made the connection to Elevator to the Gallows, because there's a big portion of the, not a big portion, but a not insignificant portion of the documentary that's dedicated to, the time he was in Paris, because that there sort of was a bit of kismet, I guess, involved. Louis Malle was working on Elevator to the Gallows at the same time that Miles Davis was, I guess, in residence. One of the times he was in residence in Paris, you know, the stars kind of aligned that allowed them to collaborate. And so as soon as it popped up, Elevator to the Gallows and Louis Mayer, I thought, oh, this is how we got here.
Yeah, that was a big reason I wanted to watch it. And I'll, yeah, just learn more about him. It's such an, he has such an interesting life story.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at who he interacted with over the years too, you know, grew up in East St. Louis, rose as sort of a jazz star.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, as you said, when he went to Paris, he was like the superstar for a short time that he was there. It was, I don't know how long, I don't recall how long he was there originally, a year or two. And he was like sort of treated as this king because jazz was seen as like the height of artistic expression by the French at that point. And it's interesting how the filmmaker Stanley Nelson Jr., I looked into like some of the other films he's made, and he's made a number of documentaries on the civil rights movement and one on the Black Panthers. So it's interesting how he frames the film, showing like Miles Davis, you know, even when he's at the height of his fame in the United States, still wasn't treated that well a lot of the time, you know, as a black man in the United States, just showing the racial prejudice there. Whereas in France for a short period of time. You know, he's treated, he's meeting Pablo Picasso and Jean-Paul Sartre, and he's part of this intellectual circle. And then he comes mm-hmm. back to the United States, and there's an interesting scene where his name's on the marquee outside of this club in New York City. He's the star, and yet the police interrogate him because they don't know who he is, and they beat him. And it was one of the defining moments in his life. You know, he's beaten outside this club where he's the star, and he couldn't really jive, as anybody wouldn't be able to really jive that in your mind. Like, how is this happening? How is it so different here versus when I was over there, kind of thing?
Right, and they don't really lean into recreations. It's kind of all narration. It's the actor who's narrating as Miles Davis is Carl Lumbly, who people may not necessarily know the name, but they would definitely recognize the face, because Carl Lumbly's been like a working actor in, you know, shows like Alias and This Is Us, and I think he was like in an episode of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, he's popped up in just about every show you can think of. But, you know, he really is also delivering a performance as Miles Davis, I think.
And he does a great job with the gravelly voice.
Absolutely.
It's brought up how Miles Davis got that voice. He thought it was sort of routine surgery for his lungs, and then it just so happened it didn't go as well as they thought, and sounded like he had laryngitis for most of his years. And yeah, the voiceover artist does a good job sort of recreating that.
It's also kind of strongly implied that he pushed himself in the recovery too, that he didn't like give himself the time to recover. It's like this very sort of typical portrait of an artist who like suffers for their art, and so Miles Davis suffered for his art to the point where you know, it kind of eroded his voice, and that's how he gets. And of course, everybody who's interviewed who knew Miles Davis in the film does like some variation of like an impression of him with the gravelly voice, and Miles came over and he said, "Hey, you wanted to come and do an album?" And it's kind of funny. I guess he's just one of those characters who, because of the distinctive voice, everybody, you know, like how people, when they talk about Sean Connery, do some kind of Sean Connery impression too. But what I was getting at too, though, is that it's the film does a really great job painting these scenes, and that scene you were talking about in front of the nightclub where he's hassled by the cops, where he's like in front of his own marquee having a cigarette. And you can practically see the picture of it in your mind of some, you know, burly cop of Irish descent with his nightstick walking up to Miles Davis and like leering over him and harassing him as he's just kind of like coolly outside. And this was after Love Is Blue, which was like his big breakthrough album. So like he was at least somewhat well known in the white community at this point, and I can't imagine he would be not at least semi well known in New York, where he was kind of based most of his life. But you can really see that in your mind's eye, because we've seen it played out in so many other scenes, be in like historical from like news reports or, you know, other movies that portray racial strife, you know, this image of some white guys harassing some black guy who was just minding his own business because they're white and he's black. The other thing I found, the racial issues are kind of always scratching at the edge of the document. It's interesting to hear that the director, because I didn't actually look too much into his filmography, that a lot of stuff he's done has been in the realm of social justice and civil rights, because that stuff very much scratches at the edge of the story. It's the thing I found about the film is that it's not so much a biography of Davis the man as it is a biography of Davis the music. The biographical details are sort of incidental to what he was doing musically at that time, or how what was happening in his life informed the music, or vice versa. But the racial stuff, as I'll call it, really it's always there at the background because it informed his life in East St. Louis, where there was, I think it's, his parents were fairly well off. They were kind of like middle class black people, which were kind of rare in the 1920s and 30s. You know, how they were treated despite the fact they were socially mobile and accomplished people. How he was treated in Paris, as you said, versus how he's treated in the United States. And, you know, the film draws a very blatant distinction that his heroin problem, which was the first of many of his drug addictions, kind of came from trying to cope with the version of himself that he encountered in Paris, where he was on par with Picasso and Sartre, and then coming back to the United States where he was just another black man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does, you know, and the thing is, there are scenes where they talk about his domestic violence, and he could be a really nasty person. And, you know, sometimes you might think, okay, they're saying he's an heroin addict because of this. And you could say that, okay, that could frame him to become like that. Mm-hmm. But definitely there were other issues. And I think they do just scratch the surface on a lot of those issues. Like the domestic violence. There's one section where his wife, who's a real star of the film, Frances Davis, this uber confident dancer who he married. She's just great. And she says, she mentioned once how she thought Quincy Jones was good looking and then he hit her. But like, if you look back, like I looked at like Wikipedia page and read some more, and it's like, he was abusive all during that relationship. It wasn't like one thing. It wasn't like one party they went to. She mentions Quincy Jones and then he gets violent and that's the end of the relationship. So I think, like you're saying, it does scratch the surface in a lot of areas. I think even with the music, like if somebody was a real hardcore jazz aficionado, they might be like, it even scratches the surface with that a bit. Mm-hmm. So, but somehow it all works for me. Like, even though it is, you know, scratching the surface in certain areas, it seemed to work just because his life is so fascinating that, you know, even when they say, okay, he did sketches of Spain, and there's a flamenco influence and doesn't really delve that much deeper into the music, it's still like, okay, this is really cool how he's going in different directions now. And yeah, it's just, his life is so interesting. The fact that, you know, he's a black man in the United States and he's driving these Lamborghinis and Ferraris or whatever the cars were, these sports cars, and he's at the height of fame and wealth, and yet he's encountering these, you know, these issues, whether they're external, sort of like the racism, or they're like the internal, his addictions and his jealousy. And it's interesting from that standpoint. I think there could probably be other documentaries on him that maybe go in more of an experimental way, which might fit more with the music and his life and the turbulent nature of it. But I thought this was a good portrait, just sort of laying out the facts of his life. Sometimes not getting in as deep, but there was so much to cover. It seemed like, okay, they're going to hint at certain things, and it's almost just by hinting at it, it's almost a little more effective sometimes. It's like, okay, this shows his addiction. We're just going to show him on stage. You know, some of the video of him on stage, you can tell he's an addict, right?
Right.
Really need to delve that much deeper into it.
No, it's the film is a very good overview, and that's about as deep as it gets. And you know, you could probably put together a very interesting documentary about like the production of Love Is Blue, which again was his breakthrough. Oh, Kind of Blue. Sorry, yeah, that was his breakthrough album, and how he like recorded like several albums worth of music with his band in 3 days so he can get out of his one record contract so he could start his another record contract. Like that kind of stuff, that kind of mythology, I guess, you know, could form the basis of like just one single documentary about that album, and it would be complete and it would be interesting and you could go in depth about it. Of course, this is covering from 1926 till, you know, when he died in, I want to say 80 something. And there's, was it 91? Okay. Yeah. Cause he was in my, it was in an episode of Miami Vice, which they showed a clip of very briefly. Yeah. So he's, you know, it covers this big long period where all these creative ups and downs. And, what I found with it is that the beginning, or like the first half of the movie, where it's like covering him like as a teenager and going to these jazz clubs in East St. Louis and becoming part of these bands, and instant, you know, with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, who also became big names in like their own respective, you know, solo endeavors as well. That, you know, he goes from there to Juilliard. And while he's at Juilliard, he's also going down to 52nd Street and hanging out at the jazz clubs there. It was weird because I was watching this close to dinner time. And so my dinner arrived. I heard the doorbell. So I hit pause and I was heading out to answer the door, I looked at the time on the movie, and that's like 26 minutes have passed. And I'm like, I can't have only just watched 26 minutes of this film. Because there's just, it's so tight, and it's so, there's almost like an improv music feel to it, as it's just kind of like scatting from one part of his career at this time to another. And then as we get closer to the end, I sort of felt the length of the movie more, as we're kind of like, as he's going through the 60s, and, you know, we're going into this like stadium rock and roll. It's no longer about club jazz and small venues. It's all about the big show and the Woodstocks and all that, and how he adapts further. And then he has this period in the 70s where he's drugged out and literally doesn't touch the trumpet for, you know, 5 or 6 years. And then he comes back in the 80s and is adapting again. And it's like, not that these periods aren't interesting necessarily, because it's interesting that, you know, how he was able to stay at the forefront and change and adapt and then become an influencer in Snob, because one of the commentators in the movie notes that, you know, he also became very influential to hip hop and, you know, future music forms through this period as well. But it's, yeah, it feels like when we get to that point in the film, it's like, now we're just trying to pack everything in. And it's kind of, it feels more like an A&E biography than it does necessarily an interesting piece of just like documentary fiction, where we're kind of like we're trying to focus on like, why is this guy influential? Why should you know his name? Why should you know his music? And it just feels like kitchen sink time by the time we get to the end of it.
Yeah, I felt that too, and I felt like they felt like they needed to include, you know, everything. And when he gets more experimental, and actually, because like Bitches Brew, I think from like 1970, was one of his best selling albums, so they have to talk about that and how he played stadiums, and then like, you know, show him on Miami Vice and how he influences hip hop culture. It felt like, yeah, they felt like they had to put a lot in there, whereas early on it was more organic about how he was, you know, like you said, playing with those bands and how they collaborated and how he was just, you know, growing up playing jazz, and just felt more natural. And then by the end, yeah, they're like, okay, we have to talk about this album quickly, this one. He had a wife here for a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, we got to talk about this. We're talking about Cicely Tyson here at the end, who I didn't know he was married to her. She's a really famous African-American actress, and how she was kind of his support system. But, you know, it's given only like a minute or two to talk about. It seemed like that, you know, she was marrying him throughout the 80s. Yeah, so it's kind of, and you see that in like other films, like I think of like fiction films, I think of like Walk the Line with Joaquin Phoenix playing Johnny Cash, how that just covered the 50s and the 60s. Johnny Cash had a career after that in the 70s, 80s of varying degrees of success. He did some interesting things, and of course he did really interesting stuff before he died, when he got together with Rick Rubin, and he was doing those really sort of ominous albums and stories, like, you know, the dark cowboy kind of thing. But, you know, they said, okay, we're just going to stick with the 50s and 60s, and we're going to end this in 1968. You know, that's, we're just going to end it right there. Just to hit, you know, the real peak. And there's a lot of films that do that. And maybe with this one, it might have been more effective that way. But like you said, it's sort of this, you know, this PBS documentary where they want to hit all the points, hit all the albums, and you know, helps you with your knowledge of Miles Davis and what he did throughout his career. But as, you know, a razor tight sort of documentary that keeps you compelled the whole time. I'm the same as you. Maybe near the end, it was sort of like, okay, we're just going to touch on this, this, and this here because we have to, you know, we have to just get to everything in his career.
Yeah, by the time they get to the end of the 60s, it feels like they have said all that they need to say. That's the point it kind of goes from, like, it feels like the director had a very clear idea of what he wanted it to look like. And maybe somebody said to him, maybe there was like a note from the producer or something like, no, you got to talk about the Miami Vice years or something. I wish that, they sort of understood like where the cutoff was. Not to say that, again, anything he did after 1969 wasn't interesting or worthy of discussion, but it's very clear that his place as a jazz pioneer and sort of like bringing that music to the fore, especially in an era that's sort of known more for like the British invasion and, you know, Credence and, you know, hippie music, you know, that it, also at the same time, there was this other very inspirational, very influential art form that was going on that Miles Davis was also the vanguard of. I think that's the meat and the movie. And I'm not saying, I don't think I'm essaying anything that isn't in the movie, because the movie also recognized that's the meat of the story. That's where the interesting stuff is. What he did and how he got there. That's what Miles Davis was about. It wasn't about, you know, being in Blues Brothers and being on Miami Vice and doing Saturday Night Live. It was, you know, what was going on in the jazz clubs up until, you know, about the 1970s when he took his sort of drug influence sabbatical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think the filmmaker could have done perhaps is delve more into the struggles for him to get back. And they talk about it a little bit, like how he didn't play the trumpet for 5 years due to addiction, due to, I don't know, maybe fear of performing at that point. His albums weren't as lauded as they had been earlier in his career. So might have been interesting to just delve more into his personal crises at that point and then talk about how he did get back on the stage and performed at the end and sort of did this victory lap in the early 90s. And they show like Quincy Jones having him on stage and, you know, yeah, that was all good, but maybe they could have focused more because it seemed like his life seems like he was such a talent and he was so hardworking that early on it was such a natural progression and natural ascension for him to be like this jazz great. And then it's interesting because of addiction and maybe loss of inspiration. He gets to a point where he in the mid 70s, he's not even playing anymore. They could have maybe talked a little bit more about how he got out of that. I think they do a little bit, the filmmaker, and talk about how Cicely Tyson helps him. And in the 80s, he's back playing again. It's a little more experimental, or like, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's more like, you know, a lot different and more inspires hip hop music and that kind of thing.
Yeah, he was kind of like an elder statesman at that point, not just of like jazz, but of like music in general. So, you know, anywhere they could slot Miles Davis in as a sort of like a musical tribute, they would. A lot of great artists like have that period, you know. I'm trying to think of, I guess Elton John would be someone right now. Like anything Elton John kind of wants to do, they'll do it because it's, you know, it's Elton John. you know, if Elton John wants to host, you know, some concert on TV in the midst of COVID-19 where everybody performs from their own, you know, is he going to get anyone to who's not going to be interested in signing on? No, of course not, because it's Elton John. And I think that was very much the Miles Davis phase in the 80s, too. Nobody was going to say no to Miles Davis. And there's a certain, I think, correct assumption that a lot of great art comes from struggle. And, you know, going back to the 60s where he's like trying to kick heroin and he's fighting with his own, like the Francis, I can't remember her name off the top of my head. One of his wives, Francis Taylor. Yeah. Where she's like very clear. And there's a portion in the film where people remember him saying like letting her get away was like the worst mistake of his life. And like his biggest personal regret. I found that very interesting because there's a portion where she talks about how she was, going to be in West Side Story. And then he gets like wildly crazy about, you know, like letting her out of the house basically. And she gets to quit West Side Story, which probably would have changed her life and taken her career to the next level. Meanwhile, he's expecting her to stay at home, look after the kids, cook the meals, do like the domestic wife thing. When she says, like, I didn't even know how to cook. And he's, like, having to teach her to cook so she can be the quote-unquote wife while he continues. And, of course, that is fed back in some extent to his past and the relationship with his parents. And the movie comes very close to sort of like drawing these parallels and shading Miles Davis as not just a genius, but like a deeply flawed genius. And then it steps back and like, but then he did another album and everything was cool.
Yeah, that's the thing. It kind of, it scratches the surface. And so, like I was saying before, like his domestic violence, even the drug addiction, they talk about it, but they don't really go in depth or, but like with that's like one of those scenes that scratches the surface, but it's very powerful with his wife, Frances Taylor, because they show all these still images of her in the original cast of West Side Story on Broadway. You can tell by the pictures and from her interview, she's so uber confident. She's just a star, right? And in these pictures, you can tell she's the focal point of the production in a lot of ways. Everyone's looking at her. You've got the cast all looking at her. She's smiling. She's a star waiting to happen here on Broadway. And and then he just says, no, you can't do that, you know. And he's at the height of his fame at that point. He's just done Kind of Blue. It's like 1959. He's like, no, you can't do that anymore. And he's showing her how to cook so she can cook for him. And just the, you know, ridiculous things here. And yeah, it does touch you because she's sacrificed her dream to be this man's housewife, and it's very interesting. It's really moving, the fact that unfortunately she wasn't able to go after her dream here, where, you know, she had the world waiting for her. I thought she was definitely a star of the documentary. It talks about how she's in productions with Sammy Davis Jr. She, you know, everyone loved her. And I did some reading afterwards, and Miles Davis turned down everything, like, on her behalf. It's like, West Side Story, it shows in the film, that he said, no, you can't do the Broadway production. Then the makers of the film wanted her to be in the film. He said no to that. Sammy Davis Jr. wanted her to be in a film with him. Miles Davis said no to that. And then there was all that domestic abuse, and then they finally divorced in, like, 1966. And she had a bit of a career after that. But yeah, it just shows the controlling nature of this man, you know, who's a great artist, but who's just going overboard thinking he's a genius who can control lives almost, right?
Right. I think we're almost owed a Francis Taylor American Masters movie, or maybe missed Masters, considering how her career went. But I think that is a missed opportunity there. And, you know, I don't want to say that the film lacked focus, because I think it was very focused on getting through as much of Miles Davis's life as humanly possible. But I think I think it's safe to say the definitive Miles Davis documentary is yet to be made, and maybe that throws down the gauntlet to other filmmakers out there.
Yeah, it could. It was a great overview. It was definitely one of those, one of those documentaries, point A, point B, point C. Here you go. Here's a life. Here's everything we can put in 2 hours. But it'd be interesting to see other people dig deeper into some of those other areas of his life that, that really just sort of scratched the surface in this film.
I agree. But it's still a really good documentary. And I think, Tim, we have crammed as much as we can about it in 30 some odd minutes. So if people want to maybe get back to you with their own ideas about Miles Davis or any other sort of streaming recommendations for other documentaries you might want to watch, how can people get in touch with you?
Flash in the Deadpan on social media. Want to send me an email, flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com. That would be the way to get in touch with me.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. As always, if you'd like to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Meanwhile, I will be back on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph, and that is with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. We are also recording that in quarantine or exile or however you'd like to see it. In the meantime, you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out Guelph Politico, my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, once again from quarantine, and we will see you then.